Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Back in 2002, I was in Washington, D.C., and I picked up the Washington Post, and I happened to read an article, a really long feature article, about a guy, a successful young lawyer in Louisiana's Cajun country, came from a prominent family of Acadians, you know, the people who came down from Canada and who settled southern Louisiana. I guess his family pretty much founded Lafayette, the city of Lafayette, Louisiana. And this guy, in 1984, had been hired by the Catholic Church to defend a priest accused of child molestation. That had never happened before. No one knew anything about the thing we know about today. He assumed at the time that it was kind of a shakedown and not true. And this began a journey of discoveries for this man that he never imagined would be possible. It was the very start of the Catholic clergy sex abuse scandal that continues to rage today. His name was Ray Mouton. You know, in our time, the word hero is greatly overused and therefore diluted and diminished. You know, people are called a hero because they save their child's life. They do something that everybody ought to do, or they help a stranger in some way that doesn't even endanger them. This guy set out on a crusade to save children from pedophile priests and to save the church from itself. He opened up a door that had been locked and shut completely from outside view. He kicked it open. He was a very successful lawyer. He was rich and from a powerful family, and he didn't really have as much to lose as most of us, but he lost a lot. He lost his profession in the end. He lost his marriage, his health, his faith in the church, and he kept doggedly at it. And so, really, I think he is a modern-day hero because he's somebody who saw a huge injustice and pursued it at all cost. And the thing that's wild about this story is that he turns out to be a great writer. So he's written a novel based loosely on what he saw and has learned as this shocking story has unfolded in real life. The book is called In God's House, a novel about one of the great scandals of our time. It was published in the UK, in England, in fall 2012. It's not an autobiography or even nonfiction, but a work of fiction that is as powerful as any I've ever read. And I've been a reader all my life. You think John Grisham, things like The Firm, you know, it's that kind of legal thriller. Ray Mouton is my guest today. Welcome, Ray.
Thank you.
Ray is joining us from France, where he's lived for a number of years. It's nice to have you on the show.
Thank you very much.
So, Ray, you turned over the first rock in this whole awful saga nearly 30 years ago, right, before anybody else knew about this. Give us a brief summary of your early involvement with the story.
Well, the first thing I want to say, Court, is I appreciated your introduction, but I'd like to believe that anyone who was confronted with the things that confronted me in 1984, 85, and 86 would have done the same thing. I don't really believe that it's heroic to just do the right thing. I think all of us should do the right thing. But my early involvement began when the local diocese contacted me and asked me to represent Father Gilbert Gauté, who was the first pedophile priest ever charged in the history of the church, the history of the United States. He turned out to be one of the worst Pied Piper pedophile priests. I think in the guilty plea, there were 37 children involved. No one knows exactly how many. It was in the hundreds. At that time, I was a young guy. I was in my mid-30s. And in the beginning, I naively believed several things. I believed he was the only priest in the world who had raped children 7 to 10 years old. And I also believed he was insane. And I originally entered a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity. Quickly, my naivety was replaced by knowledge that there were other priests in this same diocese, in fact, over a dozen, who were doing the exact same things to children. And within a few months, I was summoned to Washington, D.C., to the Vatican Embassy, where I met Father Tom Doyle, the canon lawyer, and shortly thereafter, Father Doyle and Father Peterson, Michael Peterson, who was a psychiatrist, and I began to work all over the United States. And we were working in the back corridors, these really dark back corridors of the Catholic Church, places the faithful never see, far beyond the familiar altars that everyone knows of. And it was a long journey. It was a torturous journey. And the three of us uncovered the crimes, the sins, and shame that existed in the Catholic Church that everyone knows about today and no one knew of then.
Well, the book is extremely well written. I mean, it's fast-paced. It's intense. It's a lot like the John Grisham legal thriller that I described. What's the novel about?
It's about truth. I think it's about the truth that the Roman Catholic Church does not want anyone to know. International media and over 1,000 articles have identified me as the insider in the origin of the crisis and scandal. And the reason that I've been referred to as the insider is in those days I interacted with literally everyone in the church, from the diocesan level to the state level to the national level to the Vatican level. I interacted with families, with victims, with prosecutors, with media, with insurance lawyers, with diocesan lawyers. And so I had that experience, and then in addition to drawing on my own experience and then formed impressions that I gathered through those experiences, for about 25 years now, I have daily monitored the legal proceedings and media reports from all over the world. I believe the book represents the whole truth of the entire crisis and scandal, and it focuses on the hierarchy of the church, the bishops, archbishops, cardinals, and popes. In God's House tells two stories. In the foreground, In God's House tells the story of a young, conflicted Catholic lawyer and his journey in those back corridors of the church. The novel, I think, actually takes the reader behind those walls in a very realistic way, and the reader's present when the hierarchy makes these faithless, faithful decisions that chart a ruinous course and end up destroying the lives, visiting unspeakable horrors on innocent children to save the church from scandal, which, of course, they did not save the church. The very decisions that were made by the hierarchy, in the end, of course, have compromised the church's credibility on the issue, as well as eroding the moral authority of the institution. It took me 12 years to write In God's House, and the reason for that was I wanted the book to incorporate every aspect and facet of the crisis and the scandal. The difficulty was in weaving every aspect of the crisis into one character-driven narrative that would be fast-paced, intense, and suspenseful. I think a really good novel is like a tapestry where the lightest and darkest threads are drawn from the life of the writer and then are woven with thousands of other threads of more muted colors that are pulled from the author's imagination, and that's essentially how this book was built. But my first thought when I began the book on New Year's Day in Paris, 1997, was very simple. It was that the truth matters. And at that time, I realized that I needed to present that truth in fiction.
Well, so the main character, the young lawyer, is Renan Chatelrault. Is that how you say his name?
Chatelrault.
Chatelrault. Okay. He's Americanized. And so the priest is Francis Dubois, Father Francis Dubois, who resembles the, he's the counterpart, I guess you'd say, fictionally, of the priest that you represented back then, whose name was Gilbert Gautier. And, you know, the whole thing kind of unfolds, starting, as you described, your involvement with the original naive approach to it, thinking that this was a one-case, one-priest, one-shot thing that was going to be open and shut, and then just watching it all open up in a horrifying way in front of you where your awareness of the scope of it grew and grew. But so in the course of the book itself, I mean, let's talk about just in general the plot without giving it away. I mean, in a general kind of Cliff Notes version of it, what happens in the book?
The young lawyer who is originally asked by the bishop and the vicar general and the local diocese to represent the priest goes into the case with a belief, one, that the priest may be not guilty by reason of insanity, and he's absolutely convinced in the beginning that the bishop and all of the administrators of the diocese are victims of this priest as well. He can't fathom that they possibly could have known what this priest had done before. And in the discovery in just that case, the one involving his principal client, he finds out that the church knew of his client abusing children in major seminary before he was ordained. It was in his file in the seminary, and he found out that 7, maybe 8 other parishes where the church had placed this priest, he had abused children, and each time he had been moved because of his criminal conduct. And while he's discovering these things in this single case, he is working with the canon lawyer in the nunciature, the Vatican Embassy in Washington, D.C., and discovering that there are literally hundreds and hundreds of priests in religious orders and dioceses around the United States who are doing exactly the same thing, and that in each instance, their bishops have failed to report the crime to police authorities and, in fact, covered up the crimes.
Yeah, so they go on, and Des McDougall is the Vatican Embassy's canon lawyer, I guess you call him, and he sort of corresponds to the guy you knew and worked with, Tom Doyle.
Right? Yeah, I think there are a lot of people that draw strong parallels between my experience and the novel. But I want to say this. Literary critics have written from the beginning of time that many, many of them believe, as I do, that a true story, especially a big story, can best be presented through fiction. If you think of what we know of Russia in certain periods of its history, we've learned that from Russian novels. What we know of Dickens' era in England, we know from his novels. Twain painted a beautiful portrait of the America that he knew. And even when you deal with the most horrific occurrence in the history of mankind, the Holocaust, some of that fiction, like Herman Wouk's great books, Winds of War and War and Remembrance, actually portray the Holocaust better than some of the nonfiction. And when I sit down to write this book, I really started with a blank canvas. It's not that I discarded my experience. I set my experience to the side, and I made a list of every aspect and facet of the crisis and the scandal, because I've been monitoring this daily for years. I've been haunted by this experience from the very first time that I encountered it, and after I had left the playing field, if you will, and withdrawn from the battle, I became more and more haunted that I had to do something, and I knew everything about it, and I wanted to put it in one narrative. And as I wrote that narrative, it was very difficult. I had to create fiction to get all of these different facets involved. There are very dramatic things that happen in the book, In God's House, that I personally did not experience. But these things have happened in other dioceses in the United States and in Holland and in Belgium and in Ireland and in Germany and in Austria and in Italy. And I brought these events, I brought them in as fact-based nonfiction and incorporated them into the fiction. But the book truly is a novel. I once highlighted the words that were pure fiction, and it was well over 90% of the words were pure fiction.
You know, and it reads like fiction. It's, you know, again, as I said, very fast-paced, and there's a much broader scope than anything you could have personally experienced, obviously. But a lot of it is based on your intense involvement in it, because I don't know if there's anybody who is as intensely involved in the early days of this saga as you were. What's interesting to me is all of the lawyers in the book. Now, the Catholic Church is lawyered up to the sky. I mean, there's a...
That's true.
I don't know. It must be half a dozen or so.
One of the great failings of the Catholic Church is when this crisis presented itself, they abdicated morality and replaced it with legality. They literally washed their hands and handed this to lawyers who are not guided by morality, but only secular law, and what they can do in secular law. You know, the Bible tells us that he is better to have a millstone tied around his neck and thrown into the sea than to harm a little one's soul. But this is not a concern of a secular lawyer. A secular lawyer's concerns are just what he can do to avoid his client having to pay a huge sum of money.
So before this became a public story in the newspapers, you know, before you basically blew it open and put it into the open, I guess the practice was to keep it quiet, to shame the families into silence, and if necessary, then pay them off in as small amounts as possible. And that's why all the lawyers were involved.
There was no money involved until 1984. They were paid with prayers.
Oh, is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
If a set of parents appeared at a rectory and spoke with the pastor about his assistant, or they went to the chantry and spoke to the vicar general or even the bishop himself, they told them they were going to take care of it, and, you know, it was a tragedy, and this is the horror. But they worked into those conversations, and this is universally known now from litigation all over the country, is that if they told anyone about this, they could be excommunicated.
Oh, okay,
and
it was a sin.
Clearly provided for in a document that Pope John the 23rd issued in 1962, a 69-page document instructs every diocese on how to deal with these cases, and one of the things it authorizes them to do is to inform parents that they will be excommunicated if they tell the police, a therapist, or anyone on earth that their child has been raped by a priest.
Yeah, okay, so it was like was a shame game then for all those years before that.
Wow. It was an absolute horror. What actually was in place then in the early 80s was this. Whenever there was a case of abuse, that there were actually three things in play, and that's all. There was a bishop, there was a local media, and there was a local prosecutor. If any one of those three people did their job, then this would have come to light.
Hmm.
But from South Louisiana to New York City, nobody did their job. When I was involved in this case, and as you say, blew it wide open, the local weekly, and those people should have won a Pulitzer Prize back then, they were publishing cover stories every other week about my case and about other priests in that diocese who were being uncovered by the media, and they were putting those stories out on the wire. Nobody picked up those stories. You can do the research. In the 1980s, nobody was reporting this story. CBS 60 Minutes didn't touch this story until 2002. From 1984 to 2002, the major news program in the United States didn't touch it, and they knew about it. Dan Rather had a piece in 1984 that was, I think, 31 seconds, and that's about the amount of time anybody gave to this. The church was the last sacred cow.
Hmm. So basically it was like taboo. It was just one giant secret that was wrapped up several different ways behind several different barriers, and nobody would touch it.
Nobody would touch it. Nobody wanted to bring scandal to the church. I mean, they're truly the most powerful institution on earth in every way.
Especially back then. So in southern Louisiana, in your area, once you got involved, Ray, and you found the scope of the situation and how many children had been impacted by it and families were, you know, just extremely torn apart by it, was there a sense then that under the table everybody in the area knew and that the whole populace was keeping the secret along with the church?
That was before I got involved.
Yeah.
No one knew. When I got involved, it did hit the newspaper. A crusading journalist named Jason Berry brought it out. But when the people learned the truth, they turned on the truth tellers.
Mm.
The local daily, which had a circulation about 80, 90,000 people at that time, wrote scathing articles about the weekly that was reporting the truth, and concomitantly on the front page, they wrote big pieces praising the church and the bishop, the local bishop, and they even wrote scathing editorials about me because they said I was injuring everyone by not pleading this priest guilty and getting it over with.
Mm.
I lost friends over this. I mean, I would go to sporting events that my children were involved in, and old friends would just walk away from me.
Mm-hmm.
I had women I didn't even know attack me when I was dining in restaurants for representing this priest.
Mm-hmm.
It was really a bizarre time.
So you were hated both for representing him by those people who knew and resented the truth, and you were hated for exposing it, in a way, after you got going with that, by those who didn't want the truth to be known, huh? So it was kind of damned if
That's
you did
exactly
and damned
right.
if you didn't.
And another factor of this, I wasn't involved for a week before the church turned on me.
Mm.
Because I went up and visited with the priest and came back and met with all the king's horses and all the king's men, the priests and the powerful guys in the Louisiana church and their lawyers, and said, I've talked to my client, and what we've got to do, he'll identify every victim. I'll bring yearbooks to him, and we've got to reach out to every victim. And we've got to go knock on their doors, and we've got to advise them. We know they were victimized. Advise them of their right to sue us. Advise them of their right to go to the police and prosecutor. And we've got to advise them also that we will provide anything that they need in the way of therapy. You know, we'll underwrite all the therapy. Well, they looked at me like I was crazy when I said that. They said, we're not knocking on anybody's door and inviting them to sue us for $1 million. But the point was, in representing my client, it was not against our interest to identify all of the victims. He was looking at a life sentence, and the only thing we could do to mitigate that was to reach out to the victims. And so I was persona non grata with the Louisiana church immediately.
Mm.
And so I found myself walking side by side with this man who was identified as a pariah and a monster and a menace, correctly, by the media. He was those things.
Sure.
I'm walking side by side with their priest. They asked me to represent, and I'm locked out of all of their meetings, and they won't speak to me. The whole thing was just incredibly stressful for a guy in his mid-30s.
Yeah, especially for a successful lawyer who's used to kind of running the show and being in control, and suddenly you're basically hired to run a case but kept outside the fence and not privy to any of the information in the case.
Yeah,
that's a little crazy.
It was an incredible experience.
Surprised it didn't drive you nuts.
I think it did.
Well, you've come back around, so you sound sane to us.
I hope so. You know, when all this was over, I was really concerned about myself. My only hope was that F. Scott Fitzgerald was wrong when he wrote, in American Lives, there are no second acts. I wanted a second act, and I hope I'm having one. I mean, I realize now in retrospect, the legal profession for me was just an occupation, and writing's a vocation. I love writing.
And you're great at it. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We are talking with author Ray Mouton, who's written a book called In God's House. It's a novel about the Catholic clergy sex abuse scandal, but he was very closely involved in the very beginning of it down in South Louisiana, where he represented the first Catholic priest who was charged in court with child molestation and quickly realized this wasn't an isolated case. It was a gigantic scandal that we're all too much aware of now, but that nobody knew anything about at the time. And he was the one who kind of turned over the first rock and broke it open. So you said, Ray, that you started writing this book many years after your involvement in that case, a number of years ago, right? 1997. Did you know back in the 80s that you would someday write a book based on this, or did it just sort of slowly percolate up in your mind that you had to do it?
No, I had absolutely no idea I'd ever write a book. When my involvement ended in the church saga, I'd lost my faith, lost my family, as my marriage just broke under the stress, and I'd been diagnosed as being bipolar, and the doctors told me I couldn't continue to practice in my profession, which meant an end to the lifestyle I'd enjoyed. I'd literally lost everything that ever mattered to me, and I think I felt like I'd lost myself, too. Writing a book was the farthest thing from my mind, but I couldn't let go of the story. I followed it every day. And then I subscribed to Clifton Services, and as the years went on, from 86 to 97, I began to feel that I had to do something. I had to make a contribution, and I didn't know what that contribution could be. And in 97, I decided I would write a book. I had no idea that the book would take me 12 years to write at the time, and the writing of the book was very, very difficult. Even though it's fiction, every single day I was forced to revisit the most painful episode of my entire life. There were a lot of times in there where, you know, I really got tired. I wanted to quit writing the book. But whenever that happened, I would just think of those hundreds of thousands of victims around the world who have no voice of their own, and I would push on. I've dedicated the book to them. It is for them. It's their story.
What's been the reception of the book so far? I know it was published in England and has been primarily distributed in England, and if you order it today, you have to get it from a British publisher, or you can buy the Kindle from Amazon.com. But at the moment, since the book is pretty new, there's not a U.S. publisher, and we'll get to that later. We'll talk about how to get it, and it's not hard to get. But in Europe and where it's been sold and where you've had interviews and there have been articles about this and all that, what's been the reception of the book so far?
It's been really amazing. A number of literary reviewers have invoked the names of popular authors like Michael Connelly, John Grisham, and Scott Turow. Two prominent reviewers compare the book to To Kill a Mockingbird by Nell Harper Lee. One reviewer wrote that the whole time he was reading the book, he was thinking about The Godfather by Mario Puzo. And then a really literate reviewer actually compared the book to Gabriel Garcia Marquez and even Ernest Hemingway. And I think all of that was very surprising to me. And I recently talked the fiction publisher at Head of Zeus, where my book was published in London, and they had gotten some sales reports that absolutely stunned them. They could not believe that this book, a first novel, debut novel, was doing the business it is.
Well, I've obviously read it myself, and everything I said about it at the beginning of the show is true. I mean, it's really fast-paced. It's an easy read. It's hard to put down. I found myself reading it at 1 in the morning when I had to get up early and go to work, that kind of thing. So be warned. If you get this book, you're going to read it and get yourself tired. But it's an exhausting read in more ways than one because the subject matter is intense. And I don't mean it gets into extremely nitty-gritty sexual detail, but it gets into enough detail that your mind and imagination do the rest, and it'll make your heart pound, it'll make your mouth dry. I mean, it's, you know.
The reason I provided just a little detail of that is because the media, through all these years, has pretty well had to self-censor themselves. All you would read or see in television or hear on radio is Father So-and-so was removed from St. So-and-so Parish, and it was alleged that he abused children. And no one knew what that meant. No one realized
yeah.
that they were actually raping these children
right.
in many cases.
Mm.
So I had to show some of that so that the reader would understand what the Pope, what the cardinals in Rome, the cardinals around the world, the archbishops and bishops and vicar generals were covering up. You know, they're not covering up a priest hugging an 8-year-old child.
Right.
That's not the abuse.
Mm.
It's something much worse than that. But my book really doesn't deal with the abuse, as you said. It deals with the hierarchy of the church.
Yeah, and it comes across. I mean, you know, and part of the horror of the thing is that a lot of these mass rapes, even in group rapes, were going on inside the rectory, inside the church, you know, behind the altar.
In the confessional.
Yeah, I mean, in God's house, as the
Literally.
Title of your book explains. And, you know, that's a good title because it's an accurate description on several levels, right?
And that's why this issue of clergy abuse goes to the core of the faith, because there is absolutely nothing in the actions of the hierarchy in regard to the value of innocent children that either conforms to or faintly resembles the teachings and examples of Jesus Christ, from whom this church claims its moral authority.
It's a sad story all the way around. Well, you were talking earlier, Ray, about writing the book over a period of 12 years and how it took you longer than you expected to write it. And you do have an interesting lifestyle. I mean, you live with your wife in France most of the year, but you also come to the U.S., you travel to Mexico, and you travel a lot. So just briefly, how do you write the book? We just have a minute or so left. Do you have a certain regimen where you write a little bit every day, or how do you do that?
What I try to do is write 3 to 5 pages a day and then print it and mark the corrections on the hard copy, let it sleep overnight, rest it, get up, make more changes, keystroke the changes, and then move on and try to get another 3 or 5 pages done.
Sounds like a workmanlike process. All right, we're going to describe how to get the book. So the best way to get the book is just to Google In God's House, and you can put quotes around it to keep it precise. So In God's House with an apostrophe there, and you'll see Ray Mouton come up. Mouton is the way the author's name is spelled. Or you can look at In God's House website. All of these things come up then. And when you get to his website for the book, I'd urge you to read the author's biography and the author's statement in particular. Those are interesting. You can also read the first chapter there, or you can go to the publisher's website, which is Head of Zeus, headofzeus.com, and read the first chapter there to get a taste of the flavor of the book. When you go to Amazon US, you can buy it on Kindle for $1.49, I think it is, you know, the downloadable file. If you want to order a copy, the best way to do it, it'll say, go to these sellers. And so you pick out one of the booksellers in the UK that has a high reliability rating and a lot of good reviews. The one I used was The Book Depository, and I know they have many copies on hand to sell. The Book Depository. The total cost, including standard shipping, was like $27. I think it took 10 days to get to me, which is really only maybe a day or so longer than Amazon would take in the U.S., so it's really no big deal to get the book. Ray has a Facebook, Ray Mouton. Again, it's Mouton on Facebook, and he's even got a Twitter account under that same name. So you can find out a lot about the book and about Ray Mouton and about this story. Ray, I want to thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety today. It's been fascinating.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.